I call the meeting of March 6th Transportation Finance Committee to order. We have two sets of minutes to approve. Representative Keel moves the minutes of the February 27th minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Motion carried. Then we also have the minutes of the March 1st meeting. And Representative Daniels would like to move those minutes. Any other discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Carried. All right. We're moving on to today we have quite a few different overviews for us, but we're going to take on House File 3147 first, which is authored by Paul Torkelson, and I believe Representative Baker is going to present that for him. I believe we also have two amendments, the DE-2 and the DE-3. I think we're going to take the DE-2 amendment first, and Representative Baker, if you can kind of get the DE-2 and DE-3 are fairly similar to what the original amendment is. Can you, or original bill, do you want to give us just a high-level view of it first, and then we'll go into the amendments?
I will, Mr. Chair and members. The DE-3 amendment is the amendment that basically appropriates $10 million from the special revenue account to the department so they can get moving quickly on continuing the repairs of a very poorly launched system. Also, it comes with some oversight, and there's different versions of that, and it is spelled out pretty clearly in the bill about monthly reporting and how we are going to get information on certain milestones and markers being met on this, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative. Could you just hit the highlight of the original bill first before we get into the DEs?
Certainly.
I'd be appreciative.
Mr. Chair, the original bill put together by Representative Torkelson was to fulfill the request by the agency for money to continue the work of the $100 million so far spent on MNLARS. They've requested another $43 million to finish things up, hopefully, within the next year and a half or so. And of that, $10 million is today's bill that Chair Torkelson wanted to present. With that, he was asking the governor to look for ways to save this money in his agencies and areas in the executive branch, Mr. Chair. That's the original bill.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Baker. And we do have two amendments to that. The first one that we'll take up is DE-2, and that's being presented by Chair Hornstein. And Chair Hornstein does move the DE-2 amendment. And, Chair, if you'd like to kind of give us an overview of the bill itself.
Well, thank you. So I'll move this DE-2. And, Mr. Chair, the purpose for doing this particular amendment is to acknowledge that we have some bipartisan agreement now on not only addressing this problem, but the fact that $10 million is needed. And so this bill just simply moves this process forward a lot faster. I'm concerned about the original Torkelson bill because it borrows this money or takes this money from existing state agencies without a lot of direction. For example, you know, if we're going to take money from the Department of Natural Resources, what are the implications there? Are people going to have fishing licenses delayed? I don't know. If we take money from the Department of Education, what are the implications there? Are we going to have issues with reporting test results? I mean, on and on, Department of Health and nursing homes. So these are all important government services that are provided by these state agencies that have absolutely nothing to do with MNLARS. Nothing to do with MNLARS. And so this bill is a bit, the DE-3 and this House file is a bit convoluted, Mr. Chair, that it would go to these other executive branch agencies to get this $10 million when it exists right now in the DVS reserve account. So we don't have to go to the Government Operations Committee and the Ways and Means Committee and draw this thing out when we can just pass this simple $10 million appropriation that already exists in reserve. The fact of the matter is, this is a quick and easy way to do it. All we need to do is legislative authorization for the DVS to spend this money in reserve. So we agree on the $10 million. We agree on the problem. Now, we need to just agree on a quick solution. And it's my understanding, Mr. Chair, that notices have gone out to employees that are working to fix this problem. And we are making progress fixing this problem. 40% of the backlog has been addressed. We still have a lot more to go. The problem isn't solved. But we're making progress. We have a wonderful new Commissioner Clyburn, who I think we might hear from later today, an Iraq war veteran, a brigadier general. If there's someone that can fix this problem and knows how to get the job done, it's Commissioner Clyburn. And we have entire new leadership now that the governor has put in place to get the job done. So what they're asking of us is to get the job done quickly, because people may be starting to leave. They had notices that this funding is not available. Those notices went out late last Thursday. And it's quite possible that many of these highly sought-after, skilled, high-tech workers will be looking for other opportunities. There's close to 0% unemployment in this sector, Mr. Chair. So we have to act now. And so, by passing the DE2 amendment right now, we could send this directly to the floor. That's my understanding. It wouldn't have to go to Ways and Means. It wouldn't have to go to GovOps. It wouldn't have to go to State Government Finance, which I believe is the path for the Torkelson bill. We could pass this now. We could pass this off the floor Thursday. Heck, the speaker could call a session tomorrow and we could get it done. So this is the get it done fast amendment. This is the get the job done now amendment. And so, rather than this convoluted process that you're proposing in the majority, I think this is a better path forward. And again, we don't have fundamental disagreement about the need for $10 million. I think our disagreement is on the urgency of the issue, the urgency to fix it now, the urgency to ensure that these highly sought-after tech employees don't leave us. So that's a simple, straightforward summary of the amendment. I'm happy to take questions, and I would also like to have a roll call on this.
The roll call has been requested, and there will be a roll call, but we do have some questions. Chair Drazkowski, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Representative Hornstein, for the amendment. As we've been reviewing this Minlars issue, and members that have served on this committee for a while, this isn't a new thing. I mean, this is 10 years old. I've been in multiple hearings here where the departments have come forward requesting for us to extend the tax and to change the parameters to continue to allow them to access more and more of the taxpayers' money. Each time another promise of it's going to get done and it's all going to be better, and we've even got better people at the helm now. And members, we're hearing that again. And Representative Hornstein, I don't know about your district, but my district, people would like to see heads roll around this. They're very frustrated with the failures of government, and government's been failing us in this area for 10 years already. And for us, in my opinion, as I listen to my constituents, to simply turn over another $10 million again, when we have seen again and again and again that this is a behavior of this government without any accountability, would be utter insanity. The same behavior over and over and over and over again. And I would be remiss, I should probably be unelected by my constituents if I would support an amendment like this. It has no responsibility or accountability built into it, we as a body have failed to hold these agencies accountable in the oversight process to the extent, degree, and manner in which we should be. And for us to not do it again this time, because we haven't done it in the past times, would be completely irresponsible. So, members Representative Hornstein, I appreciate your amendment and bringing it forward, and I appreciate your passionate speech for greasing the skids and getting the people's money to this ineffective government as quickly as we can. But we need to turn the ineffective government into an effective one for the people of Minnesota, because it's the people of Minnesota that this government is supposed to serve. It's not the people of Minnesota supposed to be in a position to serve them. And the amendment before us is one where the people of Minnesota just continues to serve this government that is out of whack, out of step, and out of touch with the people of the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I don't think I heard a question there, so Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair and members, I would also not support the D2 amendment to this bill, only because of again, the facts that our Minnesota residents are angry. They want accountability. And to try to fast-track something without any oversight in this bill, I think is a huge mistake. I would say that's the number one thing missing from this. But also, I've been involved in this thing since 5 days after it rolled out. Our website that we set up has now taken 1,017 emails from people that are angry, frustrated, concerned, and how in the world did we let this go out so bad? The one thing Minnesota residents want is, yes, they do want us to see this get fixed. I think Chair Torkelson and myself and anybody who's been involved in this has said from day one, we want to help to get this thing fixed. But without any oversight and without any accountability, and taking this away from a very important committee chair coming up, which would be Chair Anderson with State Gov Finance, would be a huge mistake to vetting this thing out even further so we can make a better bill. I think it's our role to make sure that we get this out as quickly as we can, but it has to go through some of the steps to make sure we process this properly, but with serious accountability, Mr. Chair. So I would recommend we do not accept the DE2 amendment.
Thank you. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We know we're dealing with a significant problem, and I'm thinking it would be really nice, particularly if some of the committees actually looked at this in depth. For instance, the fact that we're dealing with a 30-year system, doesn't anybody think that that was a problem? What happened 10, 20 years ago, that this should have been done many years ago? We know businesses don't wait 30 years before replacing the system. How is it that somebody was allowed to do this? We need to set up some decent processes coming forward. I know this bill isn't going to do that, but I think we need to think about this long term, both as to why we got to this step, and it just didn't happen yesterday. As I said, it's a 30-year system. It was way due before I even came on here. Accountability is incredibly important. We need to know who has the expertise. My guess is most of us probably do not have the expertise that we need from somebody at the top. And I was really impressed with the people, our new people, and hopefully we can do something along that line. But we need to get somebody to help us determine what are the questions going forward. And as you said, if you're asking for accountability, who's going to determine the questions? And will we be able to understand that? I mean, that to me is really important. And then the other thing that mentioned the other day is this is not the only agency that has a very old system. Again, we have been not keeping up with what we need to do to run an efficient government. So whatever we do now, we also need to think about how is that going to impact the other agencies.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess in response to what Representative Druskowski was talking about, heads did roll. I mean, we have three new people at the top of minute. And heads rolled because stuff didn't get done. So if we're going to just keep firing people and firing people and firing people, we're not going to get anywhere and move forward. We've been hearing about
Minlars and the minutes and the problem we've had there since the beginning of session, since last end of last session. And it reminds me of an old thing that came up 25, 30 years ago. My son, in one of his magazines, they had a contest, office humor, best office humor. And the one that won was one that said, "The beatings will continue till morale improves." Well, this looks like we're doing a lot of beating up on Minute and not letting them do their job, not giving them resources. I mean, what this $10 million is about, resources, keeping the people on who are fixing the problem. They all got notices last week that they were going to, at the end of this month, they're going to lose their jobs, that the money wasn't going to be there, and they were going to be gone. And those we've heard from them that IT people are in high demand, and they're already out there looking for jobs and already out there applying and interviewing for jobs. If those people go away, if we drag our feet and continue to drag our feet, we're not going to have the people there to do the problem, to fix the problem. They're going to be gone elsewhere. And so, I mean, this is just, I think, delaying this longer is just creating a bigger problem that we have. And maybe that's the goal of the majority, is to make the problem bad and just so they can prove, see, government doesn't work. I don't know if that's the case, but that's what it's been seeming like, is that we hear from the Republicans nationwide that government is the problem. Well, they're creating the problems so they can point, see, there's the problem. So, I mean, I think that we need to move forward on this amendment. The DE-2 amendment is a good amendment that gets this going. It doesn't have to go anywhere else but to the floor. We can get this passed and get it to the governor's desk so we can have these people on to continue solving and fixing the problem instead of creating a bigger hole for them to have to fix later on.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hortensen, for bringing this forward. Unfortunately, I agree totally with the amendment, but it's a week too late. We should have done this last week while people still had jobs that knew what they were doing. What we're doing now is lots of people have left, and we're going to get new people coming on who just don't have the institutional knowledge that the current workers have. So that's going to push the process out 8 months. And you know what, Representative Drazkowski? My constituents want this solved, and they want it solved now. And my experience has been, I bought a car in the last month. I got my tabs and license within days. And so the problem is out there. It's getting better, as we heard the commissioners testify last week. And to still be sitting here now is not a shame on us. I'll take the blame if you wanted to. We should have done this last week. And now it's in your hands, and if you want to take it this way and prolong the process and have your constituents become worse and worse because the system is not working, then it's totally in your hands now.
Representative Renbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm looking at the DE-2, and Representative Hornstein, it's really doing what we've been doing for the last 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years. I mean, we've just put the money out and didn't put any demands for some sort of regular reporting, some kind of performance measures, some sort of detailed scheduling of what things are going to happen. And I think we have an amendment that does that. So we're really getting to the same place with the amendment. The $10 million is going to go to the department, but there's going to start to be some management oversight here, okay, and meeting the deadlines and making sure that, there's an accountability. So I think we have a better amendment in the DE-3, and I just urge a no vote on the DE-2.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, we all listen to our constituents. And in my time since I've been here, my constituents have given me a consistent message. They say, work together. They say, get the job done and do it right. And based on the testimony that we heard from the leadership at the last committee last week when we were over at the Capitol, General Clyburn and her staff, it's really clear that time is of the essence. And I'll tell you, if my constituents that were there, I think they would have said, that's new leadership. That leadership looks really capable, and we believe that new leadership, that time is of the essence. They also see the value of reserves. I live in a pretty conservative area in many ways, and I'll tell you that, for instance, the farmers in my area are maybe managing the commodity challenge right now, the price challenge, partly because they've had the reserves. When I talk to bankers, that's kind of part of our DNA. And what this amendment does is it takes the money from the reserves. That's what you have reserves for. And so it's a logical place to extract the money. In my district, talent is of the utmost. We just can't find talent. And that when you do find talent, you find ways to hang on to it. Again, acting quickly, as we heard from General Clyburn and her staff last week, is that we need to act immediately. And I think Representative Rosenthal is right. We needed to act last week on this to make sure we could conserve that talent. I can't imagine a business in Mankato that would say, yeah, we'll let our best talent go by because we want to seek some sort of getting even of some sort. That isn't the way that business is done in my hometown. I think what my constituents want is they want this fixed. They don't want revenge. They want an effective system, and they don't send us to St. Paul to seek revenge on some individuals who are not even working there anymore. They want the job done right. They want the job done now, and they want us to work together to do that. Representative Hornstein has an amendment that will allow us to do that. I encourage a yes vote.
Representative Sandin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing we all have in common at these tables, we enjoy a distance from these issues. It doesn't affect us personally right here and now today. But we have a responsibility to our constituents. One group of the constituents that we haven't talked about are the deputy registrars that are suffering with this mess, hands-on every day. And we owe it to them to bring this issue to conclusion, and I think the DE2 does just that. We're talking about the same amount of money. We're talking about one different pocket or another. So I know the cameras aren't on today, but I hope people do pay attention to what we're not going to do today. We're not going to solve a problem. We're just going to prolong it. We're going to kick it down the road. The deputy registrars, and as importantly, the customers continue to take a beating on this. And I just remind every person at this table, there's an amount of embarrassment that should be put upon us for not taking action today. Thank you.
Representative Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Many things have been said that are we want to follow up on. In my area, I have heard from a number of people that don't want to give any money, more money to this. They are sick and tired, and they are fed up. And they blame it on the administration that's gone into this. So many people don't want me to vote for anything to go. So when I look at this plan saying, you know what, we should be looking at places to save money elsewhere in order to pay for this, that I believe I can take back to my people back home and get them to accept. I don't think that's unreasonable. And when we talk about losing talent, we're not going to lose everyone. Everybody that got the notices knows they have till the end of the month, and we have time to work on this, and that we are working on it. The one thing I will say is if we can get some new blood in there, that'll be a good thing. I have been on construction projects over and over again where you get behind schedule, your management is saying, what is going on here? And you bring new people in. You leave a few people that have been there, and you bring new people in with a new perspective and a new attitude. And that's how things get done, and done better, and fixed. I think the proposal in the DE3 amendment is the right way to go. We need oversight. I love the fact that we have new people at the top, and I want to believe they're going to get it done. The cynic in me says I've heard this over and over and over. So for me to just blindly say, okay, I accept it, I trust you, I want to see the oversight this time. I need to see the oversight this time. I want to give them the chance. That's why I'm willing to vote for this ultimately and give them the $10 million. I want them to succeed, but I can't just blindly give it over and say, I believe you. Good. Here we go. I need that oversight. So please vote this one down and vote for the DE3.
Thank you. Commissioner Clyburn, I think, is here. Does she want to speak to this amendment or at this time or not?
Yes, please.
Please come up to the table and introduce yourself and give your testimony.
Good
Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 3147 and the DE 2 and 3 amendments. This funding is urgently needed.
Please identify yourself, too, for the record.
I'm sorry. My apologies, Mr. Chair. Okay. Joanna Clyborn, Commissioner of Minnesota Information Technology Services.
Okay, go ahead.
This funding is urgently needed to continue the work on the MNLARS roadmap that was released on January 31st. If we think the citizens of Minnesota are angry now, imagine their anger when this work comes to a screeching halt. Imagine the frustrations of our deputy registrars who have to deal with the customers on a day-to-day basis. Imagine the continued frustrations of those other stakeholders, such as the auto dealers, who are trying to conduct business. Actions speak louder than words, but words do matter. No doubt this is a mess and has been a mess, but I'd like to point out that no acknowledgement has been made at all about the projects that have gone successfully under Minnett's leadership. But that doesn't really take us to the situation we are here. I appreciate that after all that has gone on in the last week and the week before hearings, that this committee is moving forward today to allocate funds. But I want to make it clear that the administration's concerns about source of funding in this bill are real. The governor is concerned and feels strongly that the best source of funding for the current fiscal year is the available balance in the DPS special fund that is available. There is currently $10 million available in unobligated balances in these funds. This is the exact same fund source that was used by the legislature last year to fund the MNLARS maintenance. These funds are intended for driver and vehicle service costs, and it would be entirely appropriate to use them for the MNLARS system. Using this funding source is a smart and common sense approach because it permits the project to move forward to resolve the outstanding issues immediately. It ensures the legislature has adequate time to consider options and to move forward with the final solution that meets the needs and expectations of Minnesotans. It does not impact the surplus in the general fund. The governor does not support reducing existing appropriations by $10 million. This is unnecessary when there is exactly an appropriate funding source available. The DVS funds have an existing balance and, again, is available specifically for purposes just like this. Furthermore, requiring reductions from unrelated programs in areas would cause undue burden on agencies that absolutely had no involvement in the MNLARS progress. Nor would it be possible to make general fund reductions from Minnett services because I don't have that in an operating budget. My operating budget comes from agencies via service level agreements, and very little of our operating funds come actually from the general fund. I also want to share some concerns about the DE3 amendment at hand. At Minnett and DPS, we're open to new mechanisms to ensure there is sufficient oversight and transparency around the MNLARS project. I have made that clear from the moment that I took responsibility and leadership for this organization. However, I am concerned that this bill places project oversight potentially with the wrong entities. For example, MMB has shared their concerns that it does not have the IT expertise to provide an IT program oversight function for MNLARS. If MMB was required to sign off on project schedules, performance measures, and progress reports, they would actually need to hire a consultant to make those determinations, adding cost and time to the project, and would create a significant fiscal impact on your bill. At the same time, it is important that any mechanism that we put into place or into law to ensure oversight can be crafted in such a way that will provide lawmakers an accurate picture of progress to allow the project to continue making progress. It is important that we balance our new reporting mandates around the project in order to keep the IT project staff moving and focused on the task at hand and improving the MNLARS project. Specifically, I am concerned about the monthly reporting performance measures that are subjective and not easily quantifiable that will particularly be onerous to measure and report, if not impossible. Part of having effective measures of performance and effective measures of accountability requires clearly understanding what you are accounting for and how that progress is being met. is particularly important to make sure that the team is focused on improving the system, because we expect many of the current MnLARS contracts will leave the team in the coming days. Since the notice that I was required to provide last Thursday, we have been informed by many of our contractors they are seeking other opportunities. Makes sense. I have a mortgage to pay. So does everyone else. If you're not sure if you're going to have a job at the end of the month, I'd be looking a way to keep the roof over my head and feed my babies. As I previously communicated in the hearings and by email, this will have a crippling effect on our progress in improving the MnLARS system, and it will cause severe slippage in the project roadmap. It is difficult to estimate how much slippage will occur in the project until it's clear to me how many contracts actually depart and the team that remains behind and what roles they can fill and what skill sets I have retained and what I still have to hire. But you, as policymakers, should be aware at minimum that it will take weeks to recruit new contractors and several months to train those contractors to the level that they need to be in order to be productive and to ensure they have the appropriate knowledge transfers. Our agency and that of DPS will be reaching out to Representative Torkelson to work together through our concerns. But until then, I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today and to provide my testimony.
I believe we do have a question or two for you. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. So we're talking about $10 million in this amendment. Can you remind or refresh the committee? I believe it was in February where we heard the $43 million. So could you refresh the committee on will there be additional dollars after this, that this is not the end of the amount of money that's going to be needed?
Commissioner Clyburn?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. The 10 keeps us through the current fiscal year and allows us to continue working the progress and the updates as needed. However, in order to finalize the MnLARS project, there is a additional request of what would be 33 remaining, right? So 43 minus 10 would be 33 remaining.
Representative Lucero, a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a follow-up comment. I just want the committee to be cognizant of that, that while we're having a heightened discussion right now on $10 million, this is not it. And that's why I think it's more important than ever before, because more money is going to be required to vote down DE2 and instead DE3, which has greater mechanisms for metrics and accountability as we move forward with the spending of money. And $28 million entails as well. Yeah, that's another item. So $28 million on top of that. So, yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the contractors you reference are private sector. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
And so, Mr. Chair, my understanding is the timeline, correct me if there's an error, a system was obsolete. A private company, Hewlett-Packard, was given a contract. After a period of time, it was clear they had failed to deliver on that contract. And so the department took action, so that I would think would be the first kind of accountability action. They were replaced. There were internal challenges. And since that time, top leaders in the department have been replaced. That would be sort of accountability step number two. So as at several points when it was clear the direction wasn't working, there was an accountability action taken. And now we have new leaders in place with a plan. And that plan simply asks us to allow you to spend $10 million of existing money, not new money, but it authorizes you to spend existing money on this purpose. Do I sort of have the timeline?
Commissioner Clyburn?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you do exactly have that timeline correct. And so you are correct, and I will reiterate that there have been failings in this project, but that past looking cannot hinder our continued forward progress. And so while we need to continue to make adjustments and we need to hold people accountable and responsible, and I've already testified in front of the committees as to processes and what I'm in progress of doing, at this point I'm at a juncture where I need action in order to continue to make forward progress. And I need the support of providing the $10 million so that I can continue to make that progress for Minnesotans and to prove to this committee and to the rest of the state that we, in fact, do have what is needed in order to make this successful.
Representative Hausman, do you have a follow-up?
And just one follow-up then. And what you're warning us about today is if the action we take brings everything to a screeching halt with an idea of somehow starting over with a plan that nobody is quite clear about, you're telling us some of the consequences of bringing us to a screeching halt.
Commissioner Clyburn.
Mr. Chair, Representative, from the moment that I took leadership of this organization, I've made it very clear that I will share both the good and bad news with everyone. And as soon as I became aware, I suspected already that when you give notice to contractors in a zero unemployment market that they were going to be bailing ship, I let you know. When I started having discussions with those individuals and it was becoming clear that this was the course that they were taking, I sent an email to both the House and the Senate confirming the information that I had. It is correct. I am warning you of what will occur. The exact fallout, I do not have that information because until everyone leaves of my 39 contractors and I figure out who's left and who isn't, it's hard for me to tell you the exact effect. But I am telling you now that there is no doubt in my mind that this is going to cause slippage and it's going to cause issues. Even those that are continuing employ right now, they're trying to do the, what we call the quick fixes, the low-hanging fruit that needs to check the box that says we're doing things. But they're not capable of tackling the hard problems that we need to fix. Makes sense. So my job is to make sure that you understand the pros and cons and the risks that are involved in the situation, and ultimately the decision is before you. But at least I have done my responsibility to let you know where I stand and what I'm concerned about. Madam Chair.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for being before us, Commissioner Clyburn. One of the things I heard in her statement is the importance to meet quickly, it sounded like, as how I interpreted, with Chair Torkelson. And I don't know if I a nod or, well, is that accurate? It would be important to have a meeting with Chair Torkelson.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, representatives, that is correct. It would be. We've had communications, and I've been available as needed whenever I've been asked to, so yes.
Okay, so then Mr.
Representative Bernardi, go ahead.
So Mr. Chair Petersburg, I guess that's what your role is today. What is, I understand that Representative Torkelson is in Washington, D.C. this week. Do you know when he'll be back to become available to have this important meeting with the commissioner?
My understanding is sometime Thursday night or Friday he is returning. Representative Gosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Clyburn. I don't envy your position and the roles and the tasks and the charge that you have in front of you. And, you know, it's frustrating that the blame is trying to get pushed on us as legislators. You know, we're getting our backs pushed against the wall. We want a system, and Minnesota wants a system that's going to work, and I'm not real confident that's going to happen. You know, I'm hearing, you know, because of the governor's lack of oversight for his last 8 years on this project and failure to manage this and ultimately the commissioners below him, it kind of just sounds like you're laying the groundwork for future failure, and that's what my concern is. And, you know, we don't know where we're going to get this next $33 million either. But I'm concerned that this isn't going to be done in a manner that it deserves to get done for the future. And I'm also concerned further down the road of the ability to lay out real ID. And so there's a lot of big concerns here, and I don't think it's inappropriate for us to ask for some accountability from you and on this task going forward. Thank you.
Well, I think that is the end of discussions, and Chair Hornstein, I'll let you close in just a minute, but I want to put in a little bit of my two cents worth in regards to it really has been complicated for all of us involved that are involved with this, yet to the average public, there are a lot of questions out there as to how this occurs and what the processes are. So I would like to share with you just a little bit of a story that kind of, I think, exemplifies exactly how we're dealing with this and what the public understands. And this scenario revolves around my wife and I deciding to sell our house last summer. We're just using this as an example here. And we get it sold, but we lose possession January 31st of the following year. Well, we quickly run into some contractors that we want to really hire. And we have this one contractor that we really appreciate. Hasn't really done a house before, but has done a very good job of storage sheds and other areas, and we know they're capable of doing that. And we contract with them to build this house for $100,000. And we set them to do that. And the only input that they get is from us. They don't go to an architect or anybody else that has an overall design. And we say we want three bedrooms, we want a living room, a kitchen, and a bathroom. And we get close to the end of the year, and all the assurances are, yep, we're building it, we've got the walls up, and we're getting it ready to go. January 1 comes around, which we would really have talked to them about. That's the deadline. We want a house to be built so we have a month to really live and move in. We agreed on $100,000 for that project, and they said, yep, we're going to do this. In October, they said, you know, we've had some delays, but we're still going to get it done in time and underneath the same budget as we had before, $100,000. And so we rely on that. First of January comes back and says, well, the house is up, but we have a lot of things yet that need to be done and fixed. But you certainly can move in since you need to do that, because we're losing our house the 31st of January. So we move in, and that first night we go to the bathroom, and the bathroom is only 3 foot by 3 foot, and the only thing in there is a toilet. And we tell the contractor, well, that's not workable. And he said, well, yes, but with all the other rooms that you wanted us, that's the only size that was available because the walls were already up. And so, well, what about a sink? Well, yeah, we're going to put a sink above the tank because then that'll get it to work. And we said, okay. So then when we go to the bathroom, we sit, and the tank is behind us. And we said, well, what about the shower? Well, we'll put in a shower. We've got a valve and a hand thing that we can do, but we'll need a drain. But we didn't plan for that, so the drain's actually in the bedroom next door. So we're going to have to tear up the foundation in order to get it working. And that's going to take some extra time. And they said, well, the kitchen sink is in the wrong spot. Yeah, we know. We can do that for you, but it's going to take up more time. And so then the 31st of January comes in. We don't have any other place to go. And they say, oh, by the way, in order for us to finish, we need 10% additional dollars today for us to actually keep working. And by the way, by next summer, we're going to need another 30%. And we aren't going to fulfill our timelines. Now, my wife and I don't have a choice. I mean, we're in that house. We don't have anywhere to go. And yet, the contractor is asking us, without any kind of assurances, in real assurances or timelines that are accountable, we don't have any way of knowing whether or not they'll complete or not. We just are supposed to trust them like we did back in October and November when they said they would get it done to us on time. Now, that kind of is how the public is seeing this whole situation about us listening to assurances that things are going to getting done. Now, please understand, I know that everybody that's involved is very earnest and really want to do the best. All of us want to make this succeed, especially my wife and I who need the house to live in. But we also think it's not unreasonable for us to ask for some sort of guidance, oversight, and being more involved with the product as it moves forward so that we actually can come to some sort of reality into the future that it's actually going to happen. And so that's one of the reasons why I think that whereas the DE2 does give the dollars, it gives the 10%, it doesn't go the next step, which is how can we be assured that we're going to get the job done other than just the contractor saying they're going to, which they have said before. Now, I realize, Commissioner Claiborne, that you've not been in that position before, but that's kind of how I see it. So I also would recommend no on the DE2, and let's move on to DE3. Let's get the dollars to the commissioner so she can use it, and then let's figure out how ways we can stay more involved and informed. And so with that, I'm going to allow Chair Hornstein to have the final word.
Okay, just a couple of thoughts of some of the things that have been said. I think, Mr. Chairman, you gave a great rationale for why we need some more government regulation to protect consumers from unscrupulous contractors. But all that aside, I want to just respond to just a couple of comments. First of all, you know, Representative Baker in particular, you know, you've done just great work in organizing hearings, and that process needs to be ongoing. And, you know, we don't have, many of us don't have issues with performance measures. I think some of these make sense. As the commissioner said, some of them don't. And we have a history in the legislature of oversight. You know, this committee has done a lot of, has had a lot of interest in the Metropolitan Council, for example. That we created a legislative commission on metropolitan government so that those issues could be aired in a transparent way and there would be ongoing oversight. There's creative things we can do. Unfortunately, and so there's some things in Subdivision 3 that I think make sense. Others don't. But the bottom line here, members, is that unfortunately, the bill as it is without amendment will cause more delays, will cause more private sector contractors to leave. It will make a bad problem worse. And so you have a convoluted funding source that doesn't really make a lot of sense to take money from other agencies. There's lots of important issues we have to discuss with Real ID. Those have to be vetted. And so we are simply saying, let's get the job done. There will be opportunities. We are in bipartisan agreement around some of these performance measures. I believe Commissioner Clyburn is very interested in that as well. But we have no time to lose. We have no time to lose, members. And as Representative Hansen said last week when the Republican majority had an opportunity to act, this is on you now. And I also heard one of your leaders on Friday say, well, maybe we'll wait for the supplemental budget on March 15th, and we'll wait for a proposal from the governor then. So I just see stalling. I just see treading water. I'll just conclude by saying, you know, repeating, I think, what Commissioner Clyburn said, which is so important, that not only are contractors seeking other opportunities, but we are impeding forward progress every day we delay. We are impeding forward progress. So once again, Mr. Chair and members, I am giving you, giving all of us, the opportunity to act in the public's interest. We heard last week from deputy registrars that they want action. They said that on the record last week at our hearing. A week ago, Tuesday. Here we are another week. Maybe I don't know how many weeks it's going to take to get through the committee process. Maybe you're waiting till March 15th and a proposal from the governor. This is simply unacceptable. So let's solve problems, members. Let's solve problems. Let's get the job done. Let's vote yes on the DE2 amendment.
Thank you. Chair Hornstein renews his motion to move the DE2 amendment. Roll call has been requested. And, Mr. Moyer, please take roll call.
Torkelson. Petersburg?
No.
Hornstein?
Yes.
Baker?
No.
Barr?
No.
Bernardi?
Yes.
Daniels?
No.
Draskowski?
No.
Gunther?
No.
Houseman?
Yes.
Howe?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Keel?
No.
Kosnick?
No.
Lucero?
No.
Mason?
Yes.
Miller?
No.
Nelson?
Yes.
Rarick?
No.
Rosenthal?
Yes.
Runbeck?
No.
Salk?
Yes.
Sundin?
Yes.
The motion does not prevail. Moving on, the DE3, and I believe Representative Baker is moving the DE3 amendment, and to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think that was an important vote, and I think we should actually roll call the next vote as well, because it's important to show Minnesotans we want accountability for the system. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will recommend a roll call on this vote as well. But the DE does exactly that. We've talked about this enough, I think, to show good starting points with oversight. Even the commissioner herself admitted that that's something that they want to do. What we have to agree to is that we just can't always take their word for it. And this gives us some ownership and credibility with this as we continue to move this bill forward. We'll find the right kind of mechanisms to oversee this agency in a better way. This bill also includes a provision that was first introduced by Representative Regina Barr, directing DPS to issue a request to make sure we have explored an outside vendor to make sure investing more money into this is the right thing to do. It's a good conversation to have. We just want to make sure that that has been explored deeper, and that's the kind of thing we need to do. One of the things that you've heard here too today, members, is that there's been a lot of leadership changes, and there has. I will tell you the leadership changes have been positive. I have already really come to respect the work of Ms. Bailey, Commissioner Claiborne, Ms. Redwing on the Minute side. However, that's half the project. The part that hasn't had a lot of leadership change is DVS. We still have the same leadership there. So what my concern would be is we have to make sure the folks running the business side of this project are still giving the IT folks who build the project the right kind of information so our deputy registrars are not going to be left out there again with the same outcome that they've gotten already. So that's just a concern that I raise, that there has been some very good moves in leadership, but we haven't gone far enough, in my opinion. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll look for questions and advice, but as we try to pass this bill today, it's not easy for me to come to our members and ask for another $10 million on this project that has gone so poorly. But I'm willing to, as well, support more money to this project quickly. But we also have to acknowledge more is to come. We have more questions. We have to vet this thing properly. But we have got to make sure people are held accountable for this. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll take any other questions.
Thank you. Before we get to questions, I do want to apologize for the committee. I failed to mention the vote for the last one was 9-4 and 13 against. And we do have some questions. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker. I agree with your assessment of the new leadership. I really do. I had not met Commissioner Clyburn before the committee last week. And, you know, you reach a certain age and you've met a lot of people. I know you've hired a lot of people. You can see sometimes it just comes out, and it was reinforced today. And it's in that vein that I ask you a question about her testimony, and I'd like your response. She raised some issues about some of the accountability measures, and I assume your support of the DE3, that you're dismissing, you don't agree with her on that. I would like to hear your response to her concerns about the accountability measures and the impacts, some unintended consequences that she identified in her testimony today.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, great question. I think that I haven't seen enough detail about her accountability, what that means, how much that is. As she has claimed, too, she's only been here for 4 or 5 weeks. She's brand new to this division, brand new to this IT operation. And for her to take on this role has got to be an enormous challenge. All we want to do in this bill, Representative, is to make sure that our voice is heard from Minnesota residents that also want accountability. As this moves forward, if we find and it's agreed to by other members of our team on both sides of the aisle that says, you know what, that maybe isn't the right way to oversee this. But here are a couple of our ideas that we want to make sure get pushed forward. So I think as Rep. Torkelson has always said from day one, he wants to make sure Minute gets fixed, Minlars gets fixed. We want to be part of that solution. But part of that is finding the right kind of oversight, and this is his ideas that he has asked me to carry today in his absence. And I think as we move forward, we'll find the right kind of oversight that's efficient, that is timely, and that doesn't slow things down, but it holds people more accountable on a more timely basis.
Reverend Johnson, you have a follow-up? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question would be for the author and maybe Mr. Burris on lines 1.14 and 1.15 of the amendment that reads, By June 30th, 2018, the Commissioner of Management and Budget must, with approval of the governor and after consulting the LAC. I struggle with the language about with approval of the governor, members. We have an agency here that is accountable to the governor and inherently represents the governor that is going to be seeking his approval in the amendment. I see a conundrum there, which could provide us down the road, I think, some a situation where the question would be, did the governor approve his own department in their decisions? I think it's unnecessary language. That inherent in the language before that, when we refer to the Commissioner of Management and Budget in the amendment, that authority or approval of the governor is already there. So, anyway, Mr. Burris, I guess I'd like maybe Representative Baker your thought about that language.
Mr. Burris, do you have any thoughts? I know you have thoughts, but I mean on this particular question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Graskowski, I could see that point that any action of the Commissioner of Management and Budget would probably be in line with consultation with the governor and arguably, you know, that language is redundant. The counter might be that the governor's involvement is specifically requested under this provision to ensure that it's not just the Commissioner of Management and Budget making the decisions around what could be fairly widespread reductions in appropriations covering potentially a number of state agencies and constitutional officers.
Representative Baker, do you concur or have thoughts?
Mr. Chair, I would concur with that.
Representative Jaskowski, any more?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have that concern that there's going to be that there could be a conflict in there, and there be finger pointing back and forth. Did we receive approval of the governor or not? You know, if you want to include the governor in the language, it might clear up the dust a little bit if you said the Commissioner of Management and Budget and the governor after consulting the LAC or something like that. That might be a better way to do it. I just don't want to have the uncertainty that the language with the way it's currently structured provides.
Thank you, and I'm sure that the author will take that under advisement. Representative Howell, and then that will be probably the last testimony before we do need to move on. So, Representative
Howell. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my concern is that I'm going to be hard-pressed, and I don't even want to vote for this $10 million anyway, because it's my fear that, right, we're holding somebody, we're going to take this $10 million out of somebody's hide somewhere along the line in the administration, but my concern is there's another $33 million coming from somewhere to keep this thing afloat again, and I'm concerned that no one's given me any satisfaction that this $33 million or this $43 million all told is going to be the last ask as we go forward. And, you know, as we continue to go forward, you know, we keep adding to the pile of money that we've dumped into this thing, and I see all we get is another ask for more money that we can't stop now. You know, and we're scared of losing these experts into the IT field that got us to this point in the first place. So I'm not... don't know if I'm really concerned about losing these folks that programmed us into this box in the first place. They can't be the sharpest knives in the drawer, and maybe they're the spoons in the knife drawer. I'm not quite sure. But I just want to reiterate or make clear that I'm being hard-pressed to put a yes vote to put any more nickels into the penny bank. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we do have Representative Hausman has a quick brief word, and Chair Hornstein, and then we do need to cut debate. We have more work to do today. Representative Hausman.
Chair, and to the author on page 3, it's 3.11. A phrase you don't often see specified in a bill, in conjunction with each progress report, The state chief information officer must each personally certify on penalty of perjury whether the MNLARS project is proceeding within the project schedule. Help me understand the strength of that phrase, why a fairly unusual phrase is included, and then I would just have a comment for the audience, maybe.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair and members, I think what that is a clear indication from our author, Chair Torkelson. We've been told information in the past that has not been true. Quite honestly, in the last 8 months that we've been dealing with this and over 1,000 emails of frustrated people, we've been asking a lot of questions, and many times, and again, this is many times before the new leadership team has arrived, we have not been told straight answers. I think that is his attempt to say, be ready, because we're just not going to take those kind of answers when they're not truthful any longer.
And Mr. Chair, then, just an observation, and I suppose for the stakeholders in the audience as much as anyone, because they've been the ones bringing some complaints, and I don't know if any of them have read this amendment, because it's pretty overwhelming, the additional process that's going to go on that's not simple and that has a lot of time delays and so forth, and whether the stakeholders now understand that I'm assuming this amendment will pass, this project and its solutions and timetable, in a sense, become the responsibility of the stakeholders and the majority party. That's, in a sense, what passing this. And I don't know if any of the stakeholders who have been testifying, none of you have talked about the impact of this amendment, but I hope you have all read it very carefully and tried to picture how any of this will facilitate a speedier solution to your problem.
Chair Hornstein, a brief comment?
Yes, just very briefly, and a quick question of the author. You know, members, you know, we have an important oversight role, and we should we take that seriously, and bipartisanly we do, and I'm glad that we've had some very productive hearings up until now, and as I said before, they should continue. But we have a new leadership team that I'm very impressed with. And I feel that we're just starting out in this very adversarial way, not giving them even a chance to move forward. And so I just want to ask the author, did you even meet with Minnit to ensure that these measures, and again, I will say to you, some of these measures are important and we should use them. But did you even meet to ensure that these measures were quantifiable and verifiable, that we would even be getting to your various goals? Because I think if we continue to not even meet with the various people that we're charging to make the system better, we're missing something. So I hope that those meetings have happened. Did you or the chair, you know, meet with them in developing these criteria?
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, I was personally not involved in any discussions directly with Chair Torkelson and Minnit when it comes to the direct oversight ideas. I know he's had many conversations with Minnit and DBS like I have, but specific to that question, I can't answer for him. I wasn't aware of that or privy to that meeting.
Just one last comment.
Go ahead, Chair.
So I know I our chief negotiator here for the House in many ways is out of town now for the week. And I just feel that we have this urgency, and I don't see the urgency on the other side now to fix this. And so, members, again, we had an idea that could have been done immediately. It didn't have to go to other committees. This is going to have to wind its way through the process because of the convoluted nature of it. And I would just urge a no vote. We need to get this job done for the people here. Any more delays are going to make a bad problem worse.
Thank you. And I would be remiss in not reminding everybody that Chair Torkelson has been in phone conversations and emails with the departments all involved, and is also frustrated in how slow it's moving, and willing to work with them as much as possible as well, and always available as well. So with that, Representative Baker, do you have a quick
just a quick final word, Mr. Chair and members? I I thank you for this time today. I know it's important that we pass this off. We've got one or two other stops, but I will tell you, leadership knows this is important to move quickly. So when this passes today, I hope our friends at Minute and DVS go back to the contractors and tell them a major win was today because money is being moved through the process. That's a big win. They should be able to talk to their contractors now to say we are taking this seriously. We're on our way with a yes vote today. So I would appreciate a support for this vote.
Thank you. And a roll call has been requested, and Mr. Boyer will take that roll call.
Torkelson. Petersburg.
Yes.
Hornstein.
No.
Baker.
Aye.
Barr.
Aye.
Bernardi.
No.
Daniels.
Aye.
Draskowski.
Aye.
Gunther.
Aye.
Houseman.
No.
Howe.
Aye.
Johnson.
No.
Keel.
Aye.
Kosnick. Lucero.
Yes.
Mason.
No.
Miller.
Yes.
Nelson.
No.
Rarick.
Yes.
Rosenthal.
No.
Runbeck.
Yes.
Salk.
Yes.
Sundin.
Oh, no.
Okay, the vote totals 14 in favor, 8 against. The motion prevails, and the amendment passes. We now have House File 3147 in front of us as amended, and I think the debate is probably clear. All in favor of... Go ahead, Representative Houseman.
Mr. Chair, wouldn't the motion have to say which committee this gets referred to? Because we're in a finance committee that's not authorized to spend this money.
That's my apology. The motion before us would be to move House File 3147 to State Government Finance. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess looking at the amendment, after State Government Finance, it's going to also have to go to Public Safety because we added a penalty of perjury into that. So it's going to, again, this is going to delay this process that the original bill and the DE2 amendment would have got the money to the department quicker. Now this is going to have to go wind through the process. We may not get this done till the end of session the way these, it's going to have to go through the process. So, Mr. Chair, I'm concerned about this, and because of that, I'm going to vote no on the bill.
Thank you. Any other discussion before we vote? Again, I'll reiterate the motion is to refer House File 1347 to State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
No. No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Chair
Baker. Appreciate that. We are a little bit short on time, so we're going to move a little quickly. We have two more major overviews. First is the Airports Fund. And I believe Cassandra Isaacson is going to lead us into that. We'll have approximately 15 minutes or so with that, and then we will be dealing with the overview of ports for another 15, 20 minutes. We might run a few minutes over, but we will try to get out of here as quickly as possible. Ms. Isaacson, when you're ready, you may proceed by giving us your name and who you represent and continue with the testimony. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cassandra Isaacson, and I'm the director of Aeronautics for MnDOT. I have a presentation here for you today on the State Airports Fund. It's a special fund within all the various funds that make up funding for the state of Minnesota. I'd like to give you a little bit of context before I start going through the slides. When most folks think aviation, they think about MSP and airlines. That's really sort of the thing that is center stage. When it comes to the work that we at MnDOT Aeronautics do, we work with 300 airports in the state of Minnesota. So 300 airports in Minnesota. Of those, 135 of them are eligible for funding from the State Airports Fund. The way we would describe those airports is we call them public. So they are publicly owned airports, typically owned by a city, and they are open to the public. An example of an airport that is public-private or public and not open to the public would be Camp Ripley. There's an airport there, certainly publicly owned, but you can't just fly your Cessna in there whenever the heck you want to. You could, but there'd be probably some severe consequences. Right. And so of the 300 airports, many of those are absolutely private airports. Perhaps a farmer who has a landing strip, a hospital that has a heliport, seaplane bases, things like that. So we're talking about the State Airports Fund and the money that goes to airports. It goes to 135 of the 300 airports in the state. Of those 135 airports, over half of them are owned by a city that has a population less than 5,000 people. So we're truly talking small-town Minnesota. They have an airport as part of their community and part of their economic mix. The money that goes into the State Airports Fund is aviation taxes. So there are several primary sources of money that goes into that fund. There's an aviation fuel tax, an airline flight property tax, aircraft registration tax, and then also the sales tax on aircraft. So those aviation taxes go into the State Airports Fund, and they are then legislatively dedicated to aviation in the state of Minnesota.
While you're turning that, could I ask a quick question about
Certainly.
The airline flight property tax? Is that something that fluctuates a lot, and is there ways in which we can stabilize that too?
It fluctuates some, Mr. Chair, I'll explain how that works in a moment. I can just go ahead and...
I don't mean to take you out of there. We are...
That's okay.
Time, so.
I can... The airline flight property tax fluctuates. It's generally a function of the appropriation amount and the other revenue that comes in. So one of the unique things about the State Airports Fund is that certainly we forecast what our revenue is going to be, whatever the legislature appropriates for spending. So if all of a sudden you decided you wanted to give airports $1 billion, the airlines are going to pay a lot of taxes because their taxes would go up to make up for the lesser amount of revenue. If all of a sudden there was all the other revenue sources were really, really high, then airlines would pay less. So it has been relatively stable in recent years, and we've worked hard to make that happen, and I'll explain some of that in a bit as well. So one of our primary revenue sources is aircraft registration tax. Aircraft registration tax, if you own an airplane, you pay an annual tax, similar to having license tabs on a vehicle. There are some unique things about airplanes in that they're not titled in the same way that an automobile is. And so there's a relatively complex fee structure on how aircraft are valued. I tell people that there's really no such thing as an airplane. It's just a temporary assembly of parts. Each component of that airplane has its own life cycle, its own maintenance schedule, its own valuation that affects the overall value of the aircraft. So there's an aircraft registration tax. Aviation fuel taxes. This is a tax that gets paid by anyone who purchases aviation fuels in Minnesota. This goes into the State Airports Fund. there is a, it's tiered, and so for those airlines that pay aircraft registration tax, the more fuel they purchase when they get to those higher volumes, they start getting a refund, so those taxes come down a bit on that side. Sales tax on aircraft, this is a relatively new to the State Airports Fund. In 2013, the legislature and did some restructuring of the aviation taxes, in part by lowering some of the aircraft registration taxes. To offset that, sales tax on aircraft was moved to the State Airports Fund. This this is one of our most challenging sources of revenue to forecast, because ultimately, if one or two companies buy relatively large airplanes, that's a big dollar amount. If no one does, then it's not. And so over time, we'll get much better, I believe, at forecasting what that number is. But it is absolutely sensitive to the economy. It's also sensitive to what happens on the federal level. So if you're a business and you're making choices between purchasing aircraft versus leasing aircraft as a function of your federal taxes, those things can affect how what this dollar amount looks like. Airline flight property tax, as I explained, this tax the airlines pay in lieu of paying some other taxes, such as aircraft registration tax. They do actually have the option in state law to choose aircraft registration. None of them do, because once they added all of that up, I suspect that this is a much more a better tax. But the this tax, all the airlines pay it, and the ones who pay this tax are part of that other component of the fuel tax. Those things work together. This next slide. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to put my reading glasses on for this one. So, Mr. Chairman, you can see here this shows the what those taxes have been in recent years and then what we're forecasting them in the forward years. And so when you look backwards, historically, even prior to 2013, airline flight property tax has been in the range of 7 to 9 million. Part of that bump in 2013 is that I think for some folks it seems like yesterday, and for some folks they forgot that this has even happened. As the airlines emerged from bankruptcy and they were paying their back taxes, that's why there was more collected. So that's the collection, that wasn't the assessment for that year. That's the revenues that went into the fund. But so generally those taxes are in that range. As you look for those forecasted, those out years, the reason that those numbers are substantially lower than what you see, for example, in 2018, is that we would forecast that the appropriation remains flat. We currently don't have the next biennial budget, so we haven't even proposed the next biennial budget, and so that affects what that forecast might be. And you can see there the other sources. You can see the changes. I mentioned sales tax as you look there. One year it was $8 million. The next year it was $4.9 million. And I know that for a lot of folks who are used to seeing state revenues, those seem like really small dollar amounts. $3 million in the State Airports Fund, we can deliver 40 airport projects across the state. That's real. When you have an appropriation of $20 million, $3 million is huge. I mean, that's tremendous. The next slide there just shows you what the breakdown is. So generally when we're talking aviation, 135 airports in Minnesota, 9 of those airports have airline service. So general aviation is certainly a big component. And so this split would show that if you combined the sales tax on aircraft as well as aircraft registration and some of the fuel tax, that's what general aviation is contributing to the system. And then airline flight property tax and some of the fuel tax is what the airlines are contributing to the aviation system. So those two together fund all the airports in Minnesota. This is just the historical appropriations over the recent years, and then you can see there we're just forecasting out the future. One of the things to know about the State Airports Fund that's relatively new in recent years, so since 2013, there's been quite a lot of things that have happened. The airlines emerged from bankruptcy. There was some restructuring of the tax laws. MnDOT implemented a fund balance policy for this fund. Several years ago, under several previous administrations ago, $15 million had been taken out of the State Airports Fund in order to help balance the budget. When that happened at that time, it was included in the legislation that as soon as there was a surplus in the general fund, funds that had been taken would be repaid. The State Airport education was first in the State Airports Fund, so there was a $15 million influx. So we've had several things that have taken place. The thing that MnDOT has done to sort of help bring stability, that fund balance policy, it creates a reserve, so we have a floor, but the other thing that we put in place was a ceiling. And so if the State Airports Fund starts growing because revenues are higher than anticipated, projects aren't getting delivered, those kinds of things, it forces MnDOT as an agency to take action working with the governor's office and the legislature to bring that into alignment. So either reduce spending or increase appropriations, whatever we need to do in order to make that. So we have a ceiling and a floor so that the fund would not grow. It'll just stay so that we're pretty much, we don't spend every single penny. You know, we have that little bit of reserve because we are sort of the safety net for airports. This slide basically is just sort of a representation of how the money gets split. One of the things, a couple of things to point out. So money going to airports, I think most folks when they're thinking about MnDOT giving money to local government, everyone's typically familiar with state aid and how that works with the highway system. Generally, that's construction money. That's projects, and we certainly do that. We participate in both federal projects as well as state projects with airports. But the other thing that we do with the State Airports Fund that is a bit unique is that we participate in the maintenance and operations of airports. So what that means is, so for example, Fauston, Minnesota, Carlstadt, Minnesota, Park Rapids, all those communities that own airports, when they're out there plowing the runway, a portion of the salary of the snowplow driver is paid for by the State Airports Fund, the utility bills, some of those kinds of things. So it's those aviation taxes supporting the maintenance and operations of the aviation system, just like the Trunk Highway Fund supports the maintenance and operations of the Trunk Highway System, pays for snow plowing the state highways, those kinds of things. It's not 100%. There's a participation rate that takes place, but we do participate in the maintenance and operations of airports. The other thing I wanted to point out is the money that goes to navigational systems. So MnDOT, what we would call it NAVAIDS to be short, and so that's a whole variety of things, VORs, different kinds of equipment on the airports, weather information. When everyone listened to the news this morning to find out the condition of the roadways and what their commute was going to be look like, one of the things you would notice, it would say the temperature at the airport. Generally, it's MnDOT that owns that. We own the equipment for that. We maintain it. We provide that all across the state. So that that money goes to maintaining and operating that equipment statewide, but then also new construction when it's needed as well. Then one last slide, and certainly answer any questions that the committee might have. This is one of the other things that we've done in this last few years. One of the things to understand about how airport funding works is that the federal money that airports in Minnesota receive, it's federal money, has a lot of the same tails that any other federal money has, but it's structured differently. What most people are familiar with, where there's this pot of federal money that comes in, and then state and local government work together for putting together a plan for how it'll be get spent, and then select the projects, and then the Federal Highway Administration holds the state accountable to doing that. I'm sure you've seen the STIP, kind of that statewide list of projects. That's not how the aviation funds work. We are not a block grant state. Being a block grant state, there's only 10 in the United States. It's limited by Congress. We've talked with our members many times. Right now, FAA's bill is up again, and we're continuing to talk to them about opening that up. The way the federal money works is that it's entitlements to each airport. And so right now, projects that FAA will give money to before the end of their fiscal year, September 30th, we do not know which of those projects will get federal money and which ones will not. FAA makes those choices. Those individual projects are announced by the member of Congress, and then the city saw that. And so because of that, we participate in the federal money. It's 90% federal, 10% not federal. We participate by putting in up to 5% in the project, but we don't know until usually about September 15th each year how much exactly that's going to be. We can guess. We have a sense of it. We certainly work hand-in-hand with FAA. But because that's the history of how that's worked, airports were not doing a very good job of giving us their out-year projects. They were basically giving us a list of this year, maybe the next year, that sort of thing. In the past couple of years, we've worked really hard to put together, we want to see your 20-year list. If you've got a runway, it's got pavement on it, we know that you're going to do some sort of a mill and overlay, something like that, perhaps 8 years out, then another one 17 years out. Let's lay all of those out so that we could get much better at predicting what those things would be, so we could talk better about things like what should airline flight property tax be in those further out years. And so what you see there, the five-year list of requested projects, it's the list, completely unconstrained. The next one with available funds, we've constrained that saying that realistically FAA, Minnesota's only going to get about at most $56 to $65 million in federal money. So when that federal money doesn't show up, the local government's not going to be able to come up with the rest of that money, and neither would we. So a lot of those requests won't move forward, or at least not in those years. And so that's what that is about. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Isaacson. I appreciate that. I think we do have one question at least. We are running a little short on time. Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Isaacson, when I'm looking at the back at your appropriations slide, that huge jump in 2018 in appropriations is pretty level. What accounts for that huge jump there in the appropriations for that for the 2018 year?
Ms. Isaacson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's in part due to the way the transportation bills move forward. We ended up having to double up in some components, and so we went back and had to ask for more to spend out the money. Or we would have ended up in a situation where we would have said, well, we're just going to keep everything level and airlines wouldn't have paid taxes and those kinds of things. But that's what that's about. It was to spend down the fund because we had those things that had happened.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Isaacson, thank you for your testimony, your overview. I just wonder if all the conservatives in state government are in your department. I'm looking at your expenditures and your revenues, and you're flat, if not going down. Would you be available to train some other segments of government?
Ms. Isaacson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm happy to talk to anyone anytime. The reality is I don't know that we have all the conservatives. I'm sure we have a mix just like anyone else. Aviation is it's a fairly small community. It is very sensitive to the economy. Many people point to the economic downturn, and they look at September 11 and those kinds of things. The reality is aviation was suffering before then. Sometimes it's a leading economic indicator. And so we in aeronautics, we are very sensitive because ultimately the success of all those aviation businesses and the airports, they're just linked. They're completely intrinsically linked. An airport is this mix of public and private, and it's very different, that's for sure. And we definitely count our pennies. There's something about having being this sort of constrained piece, because we don't use any trunk highway money. My salary is paid by the State Airports Fund. So every choice we make, we know what's going to happen with it. Most of the communities we deal with, some of them have a city budget of $200,000, $300,000, and so we understand what those dollars mean, and it's...
We do meet forward. I'm sure, Ms. Isaacson, you'll be available for additional questions later. We have one more Representative Salk Dance ask the final question here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask a question, and I think this is correct, and it's about Rochester's airport, and they've got a big project coming up that's going to – somebody's going to have to be writing big checks to make that work. Because you're nodding, I'll assume I don't have to try to describe it because I don't technically know except that it allows planes to land in a much lower ceiling. The you said that you map out future costs. You know what's the condition of a runway in X, Y, and Z across the state, and you sort of merge that into a predictive set of data. What happens with a big animal like this that comes in and really is coming because of relatively significant use growth and economic growth in that particular location? So it's... How do you treat an anomaly like that, I guess, is of interest to your management?
Ms. Isaacson, do you have a brief answer for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll be brief and say that if you'd like more, I'm happy to discuss more as well. The Rochester Cat 2 project, we've been writing checks already, and we'll continue to write checks for that work. We have been working this last year extensively with the airport community, with stakeholders, aviation businesses, the airlines, discussing just that issue. The reality is that sometimes some of those budget buster kinds of projects, so that Rochester Cat 2, when it's all said and done, we're probably looking at close to $8 million. With a $20 million annual appropriation, you can imagine the kind of hit that is. So we've been exploring what it would mean to put together perhaps a capital program similar to how the state aid bridge program works, something like that. But I think you'll see more to come on that. But that is part of the conversations we've been having for sure.
Well, thank you so much, Ms. Isaacson, for sharing your overview. We really appreciate you coming down to testify. With that, we'll move on to our port overview. Deb DeLuca, is she here? And I think you're going to team tag this presentation a little bit there, so if you could identify yourselves for the record and continue on, but we appreciate that. And we are a little bit limited on time, so if you could keep it brief but succinct, we appreciate that very much.
Sure. Good afternoon, representatives. Thank you for having us here to tell you a little bit about some of the Minnesota ports. My name is Catherine Sarnicki. I'm the Vice President of Redevelopment and Harbor Management for the St. Paul Port Authority. We work closely with our colleagues in Winona, Red Wing, and Duluth to advocate for port infrastructure funding. 26 years ago, we formed the Minnesota Ports Association to give voice to the important role that our ports play in moving Minnesota's commodities to national and international markets. We really appreciate the opportunity to report on our work of facilitating the transshipments of products as they move. And I'm just going to hit some highlights because I know we're running low on time.
Thank you very much.
The St. Paul Port has three shipping terminals. We have seen an increase in our tonnage rates over the past year. We're up to over 4 million tons of commodities. That's a 25% increase over the previous year and a 38% increase over 2014. The commodities that come through our ports, we carry over 50% of the state's grains to worldwide markets. We also bring back lots of fertilizer products and soil additives to make the agricultural community grow. So that's really why we were formed. We have a lot of products that now come into our market. Instead of bringing empty barges up, we're carrying road salt. We've seen the increased demand for that, increased demand for cement. All the construction projects, PennDOT gets a lot of their cement from our tenants, and those are commodities that would be much more expensive to the marketplace if we couldn't carry them by barge. We have done a recent project with Port Development Assistance Funds to create a heavy lift pad in St. Paul, which allows us to bring oversized and overweight items without taking them long distances over the highways into St. Paul. And we are currently seeking funding to address some transportation issues and logistics where we have railroad at-grade crossings entering our terminals. And we're looking at improving the safety in those areas, reducing vehicle emissions, and providing greater efficiency to the marketplace. Minnesota ports have a long backlog of land and waterside infrastructure projects. And without the Port Development Assistance Program, we would be in a far worse state of repair. So thank you for your support in the past. Additionally, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to briefly mention the Port of Winona and tell you about them since they aren't here today. But we do have ports in Winona and Red Wing. The Port of Winona has had its two busiest seasons in 10 years in 2016 and 2017, with 1,200 barges handled in 2016 and over 1,300 last year. This represents a 30% increase over our 2015 traffic. The primary activity in Winona is the export of corn and soybeans, and they also lease space on the Port Authority dock, which has an increased diversity of commodities handled each year. For example, gypsum is a new product that they handle as a soil amendment for farm fields. They pelletize the product and make it much easier to apply the product and control the release of the soil nutrients. The majority of the commodities shipped through Winona originate from the farms in southern Minnesota and southeastern Wisconsin. And Winona is the third largest port in Minnesota behind Duluth and St. Paul. Mr. Chairman, representatives, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague Deb DeLuca of the Seaway Port Authority to tell you a little bit more.
Welcome, and please identify yourself and continue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Deb DeLuca. I'm the Government and Environmental Affairs Director at the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. Thanks so much for having us here today to provide an overview of the port's role in the multimodal transportation system of our state, and to give us a little picture of what happens at the Duluth Seaway Port Authority with the Port Development Assistance money. Moving by commodities by water, as you probably are all aware, is the most environmentally friendly, most efficient, most cost-effective transportation mode for many of the commodities that move through our state. However, as much as we need that water infrastructure, a port cannot be a port without excellent road and rail access. So when we talk multimodal, ports operate at the nexus of those three transportation modes: water, road, and rail. And that so the funding of that transportation is crucial. And what we are looking for as port authorities, we're always seeking to find ways to cut the supply chain costs for Minnesota businesses and commodities. That's what we do. We look for, decreased transit times and find efficiencies for the movement of those goods to make them more competitive in the global marketplace. So, for instance, our agricultural sector relies heavily on both the Upper Mississippi Waterway as well as the Great Lakes Seaway to move corn, soybeans, and wheat to national and international markets. Sand, gravel, cement, and road salt move into the state through our port facilities. Of course, you can't overlook that close to 90% of the iron ore that goes into steel making in this nation moves out of the Iron Range and through the ports, Lake Superior ports, including the Duluth Seaway Port, but also two harbors. Western coal is shipped on both River and Great Lakes ports, and the movement of taconite, of course, as I mentioned, is crucial to steel making in our nation. As well, huge pieces of equipment and raw materials and finished goods move through general cargo terminals, such as the one that the Duluth Seaway Port Authority maintains. And those goods support mining, manufacturing, energy, and pulp and paper industries. Well, our ports support local jobs and business revenue. And, for instance, in the port of Duluth Superior, we support the shipping traffic supports 11,500 jobs, as well as $1.5 billion in business revenues in the Twin Ports region. However, thousands of jobs and economic activity is supported by the goods that move through those ports, and those jobs are located throughout the state. As Catherine has indicated, the Duluth Seaway Port Authority
uses, as well as our river ports, use the Port Development Assistance Grant funds. We use that as matching funds for large infrastructure projects. All of us maintain these terminals that are essentially small cities of infrastructure. We have, in our CLEAR terminal, we have road and rail to access the port, the terminal, but as well road and rail inside of the terminal. We have dock walls. We have 9,000 feet of dock walls, and each of those, each linear foot costs $1,000, $3,000 to build. We have utilities, you know, light. We have every, just as I said, a small city of infrastructure in each of those terminals. We've used the Port Development Assistance Grant funds in, and I will, in that packet I provided to you, this picture illustrates all of the places that that money has been used since the late 90s when it first became available on our terminal. Two example projects. One, we recently rehabilitated the dock C and D. I know some of you have been up to visit it, so I won't go on at length. But it has what was once a dilapidated dock, no longer really usable or very minimally usable, not connected by road or rail, is now a 28-acre modern dock facility with heavy lift capacity. You know, a newly rebuilt dock wall around one, along one side. 28 acres of storage space. If you went out there right now today, you would see approximately $30 million worth of wind equipment that's that came in last year from Germany and Indonesia. It's going it's for a Minnesota Power Energy project that will, you know, add more renewables to their grid. And that is, you know, that's huge. If you see it, it's like 48 tower sections. It's to build 16 wind turbines. It's, 48 tower sections, 64 blades. I said that backwards, the other way around. Anyway, those blades are each 200 feet long, yeah, and all the power heads and hubs to hold the blades and to move the blades. So that gives you an idea of the kind of the value of the commodities that move across that dock. As well, that dock having that dock has created space and the rest of our terminal for other purposes. That was an $18 million project. $2.75 million came from PDAP, the Port Development Assistance Program. And as well, we have what we call the debottlenecking project. It's debottlenecking because our truck traffic through our terminal has increased by 300% over the past 10 years, and we are actually expecting that rate of growth to continue or even uptick. So to accommodate that growth, we built a new road, added truck scale, better separated the maritime activity from the road and rail features, and in general, smoothed out traffic flow through the terminal. Those two projects, I don't have time to tell you about it, but what's really even more exciting about these two projects is it made way to put a container terminal on the CLEAR terminal. It's right now just a road and rail facility, this tells you a little bit about it. Our partner in this endeavor is the Canadian National Railroad, but what this has done is, I mean, the degree to which we have cut supply chain costs, we have a manufacturer right within a half mile of us that's now saving $600,000 to $700,000 a year on their freight costs. We have a Brainerd furniture manufacturer that's saving a third on their freight costs. Those benefits, that allows those companies to expand, whether it's adding another line of manufacturing, whether it's expanding the facility, adding more people. It's an economic benefit. It should also serve as an attractor for businesses to our region. We have customers using that terminal as far south south of the Twin Cities. So it's a big deal. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and all the legislature, all the representatives here, for the consistent bipartisan support that you've shown the Port Development Assistance Grant Program. It really helps us with the work that we do. I will mention that that program requires a 20% match. We have, on average, over all these projects I showed you, we usually supply 65% of the funding and of the project cost, and the PDAP money is 35%. So thank you. The Port Development Assistance Program has been a real success story.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, and appreciate you coming here. We do have a bill that we want to get to here, yeah. But I just also want to on the record say, you know, it's kind of nice to have, we're not on the East Coast or the West Coast, but we do have a seaport, ocean port in our state, and that's really great. So thank you for your time. People, if they have more questions of them, the information is available here. Please contact them. I thank you again. If the committee will indulge me for just a little bit, we are going to go to House File 566, Representative Haley, who's going to present that, and I will move. And I'm going to move House File 566 to be referred to the Committee on Capital Improvement. Representative Haley, can you present this bill?
Yes, thank you, Chair and members, and I'll be brief because you heard the testimony on how important our ports are to our competitiveness, and having both the Mississippi River and the Great Lakes Seaway give us that competitive advantage. There are two ports in my district, Red Wing and Wabasha, and very nearby Winona. So in addition to the significance of the Duluth and St. Paul ports, it's helpful for our smaller communities in outstate Minnesota. So I just would request that we move 566 forward. The request is for $10 million. And that decision on the amount will be addressed in the Capital Investment Committee. I'd appreciate your support. Thank you.
Seeing no hands up, I will renew the motion to move 566 on to Capital Investment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Okay. I have two. It prevails. I have two bits of just information just to bring you up to speed. In your packet, you have announcement of the autonomous bus. Taking tours around the Capitol courtyard, or well, it's not really a courtyard, what is the mall, around here on tomorrow, Wednesday, March 7th, from 9:30 to 3. It's an autonomous bus, if you want to see that. Our next meeting is also on autonomous vehicles, and we are moving that to the Capitol building, room 120, so just mark your calendars for that. With that, I adjourn the meeting.